The headlines: Iran calls for global nuclear disarmament, saying Israel's nuclear weapons pose a threat to peace and security of the region and beyond. Jordan fully reopens its main border crossing with Syria after a decade and is set to resume flights to its neighboring country next Sunday. The former Australian Prime Minister says his successor deliberately deceived France when he scrapped a submarine deal with Paris in favor of U.S. or British alternatives. Hello and welcome, everybody, here in the Iranian capital, Tehran. This is World News. Our top story for this half hour: Iran's deputy foreign minister has called for global nuclear disarmament, saying it's the responsibility of all governments to eliminate the threats of these weapons. Reza Najafi made the remarks in the U.S. city of New York during a United Nations General Assembly meeting on the International Day for the Total Elimination of Nuclear Weapons. The Iranian diplomat said the Islamic Republic strongly rejects preservation, storage, proliferation, and development of nuclear weapons at global and regional levels. Najafi stressed the implementation of the 1995 UN resolution on the Middle East, which endorses a region free of nuclear weapons and other weapons of mass destruction. The Iranian diplomat called Israel's nuclear weapons an obstacle to the UN resolution. Najafi said the regime poses a threat to peace and security in the region and beyond. Political analyst Mohsen Saleh says the international community must put an end to the illegal conduct of Israel and the United States in the West Asia region.
The Zionist occupation of Palestine has been overlooking all the international laws and protected by the American hegemony and the Western Union. And I guess they have, from the 50s, 1950s, they have a large amount of this nuclear bombs overlooked by the nuclear the international nuclear agency. And now everybody should know, and everybody knows also, that this Ruge institution, protected by the West and the Americans, should become in the front of this international community and should be put an end for its project, which threatens not only the Palestinians, but also the whole region and all the international peace process, if they are really willing to make peace in the region. But it seems that the international community are still stubborn and not committed to the laws they put in order to put an end to this nuclear proliferation in the region. Now it's about time to put an end for this game of the American, Zio-American interests going illegally to the end to threaten the life in this region.
Elsewhere, the leader of Iran's Islamic Revolution has appointed Peyman Jebeli as the new director of the Islamic Republic of Iran Broadcasting. In a message, Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei has wished success for Jebeli in his new post and thanked the services of outgoing IRIB director Abdul Ali Ali Askeri. Jebeli holds a PhD in culture and communication and has served in various positions in IRIB. The 55-year-old was appointed deputy director of IRIB World Service in August 2016. He has held other posts in the corporation, including CEO of Press TV and Al Alam News Channels. Following his appointment, Jebeli pledged to focus on promoting new Islamic civilization during his five-year term in office.
Our slogan in this phase is to step in order to realize the new Islamic civilization. This is what the second phase of the Islamic Revolution focuses on. The meaning that we have to make the borders of our audience beyond the borders of Iranian audience.
Jebeli said all national capacities would be used, especially the capacities of the young elite. In the new era of IRIB, he also pledged to strengthen the IRIB World Service to better convey the message of the Islamic Republic beyond the country's borders. News review, where we look deeper into some of the top stories of the day. In this segment of the program, Jordan has fully reopened its main border crossing with Syria in a step to restore extensive business ties with Damascus. The Nasser Jaber crossing was a transit route for hundreds of trucks a day before the Syria conflict started in 2011. Jordan's state carrier, Royal Jordanian, will also resume flights to Syria next Sunday after a decade-long hiatus. Bilateral trade between Amman and Damascus amounted to over $1 billion a year before the start of the war. Jordan was a staunch supporter of militants fighting to topple the Syrian government. Joining us on this edition of the News Review, we have journalist and political analyst Elijah Magnea joining us from Brussels. Also, we have Professor of International Relations at Lebanese University, Mr. Jamal Wakim. Gentlemen, welcome to the program. Let's start off with Mr. Magnea in Brussels. Give us your thoughts on the significance of what has taken place with regards to the main border crossing between Syria and Jordan.
Thank you for having me. I think it's extremely important, particularly when the U.S. and the EU have imposed heavy sanctions on Syria, including the Caesar Act against the Syrian Arab Republic. By allowing this relationship to blossom between Syria and Jordan, it means that the Americans are giving concessions to Jordan. They are softening their hard stand against President Bashar al-Assad of Syria, and they're allowing the relationship to resume to a normal stage as they were before the 2011 war. And that started when King Abdullah visited Washington, and then the relationship continued between Jordan and Syria on another level, where the interior ministers on both sides talked to each other, and then we saw the visit of the Syrian defense minister to Jordan, meeting also the Jordanian chief of staff. And finally, we see also the gas supply from Egypt through Jordan to Syria and Lebanon, where Jordan, Syria, and Lebanon will highly benefit from this new relationship that the Americans are allowing it to happen, which means that Syria is going to be embraced once again, slowly but surely, into the Arab League, and then the war will be behind everybody.
General Wakima, I'd like to get your thoughts on the issue as well. A lot of focus is now being put on the issue that Jordan initially was a supporter of militants fighting to topple the Syrian government. Apparently, the situation on the ground has changed with it. Politically, everything has changed as a result. Tell us more, please.
Well, I believe that Jordan have not done this act or this move had it not been for the consent of the United States, which has given the green light for the Jordanian government to open relations and normalize economic relations with the Syrian side. And this is a first step towards the United States admitting the failure of its projects to topple not only the Syrian regime, but Syria as a country and divide it along sectarian and conventional lines as part of its plan to redraw the geopolitical map of the region. So now that we see Jordan opening up relations with Syria, this is a sign that the whole policies of the United States in the region have failed, and that we are heading towards normalization of relations, stabilization of the situation in the region, and of course a retreat of the American influence in the region, because the Jordanians are trying alongside other Arab states, including Egypt and Saudi Arabia and the UAE, to contain, let's say, or to attract Syria to their side in order to distance it from Iran, especially that the plan to, as I said, to topple Syria as a country has failed. So we'll see more and more normalization steps, not only from the side of Jordan, but also from other Arab states in the near future.
Mr. Magnier, as our guest in Beirut just said, normalization and stabilization of relations with Syria ultimately point to the failure of the U.S. policies regarding Syria. What does that failure entail? Does it also mean that we would most likely be seeing an exit of U.S. forces and an end to occupation of areas and territory inside Syria as well?
As Jorgen said rightly, the war in Syria showed that the Americans, the allies, have failed to change the regime and create a failed state in Syria. And notwithstanding the military room that were open in Turkey and Jordan, they all admit today that they have failed. What they're trying to do today is to make sure that Syria can regain its position among the Arab leaders and Arab states, and then normalize the relationship. But that cannot happen without the withdrawal of the U.S. forces from the border between Syria and Iraq, that is at Tanf, and from the northeast Syria, where there is the oil and gas and the agriculture that supply to the country. Now, we see that President Biden doesn't have really a clear agenda towards Syria and doesn't know what to do, because first, Syria is very far, is not part of the U.S. national security, but the presence of the U.S. in northern, northeast Syria, occupying that part of the country, is only to please Israel and to allow Israel to attack Syria or Iraq using the American bases. Now, we see the relationship between the Americans and the Israelis in going into a different direction in the Middle East, and we see Biden withdrawing slowly but surely from West Asia. And that will fall into the advantage of Syria if the U.S. forces withdrew from Syria sometime next year. And I don't think that is impossible to achieve.
Professor Joachim, your thoughts on the same issue as well. We've heard Syrian officials time and again stating that U.S. forces and even forces from Turkey should end immediately end their occupation of Syrian soil. Do you think that a pullout of U.S. forces is on the horizon? And if that happens, what does it mean?
Well, I believe that the United States are trying to disengage from direct intervention in eastern Syria by relying on their proxies, who are Fasad, the Kurdish party that is trying to impose an autonomous region in that area. But at the same time, I don't believe that the United States wants to fully pull out from the region. They want to minimize their cost by trying to monitor things from their bases in northern Iraq through their Kurdish allies. And this is of high geopolitical significance, because they are trying to drive a wedge between Iraq and Syria on one hand, and of course to damage land communication between Syria and Iran through Iraq. So this is highly important for the United States to block the Eurasian powers, namely Iran, Russia, and China via Iran from having access to the East Mediterranean. So that's why I believe that the United States are trying to keep hold of certain strategic areas in the region, including northeastern Syria, but with minimal cost. They are also trying to improve their or strengthen their hold on some regions in Lebanon, especially the region stretching from northern Beirut all the way to Batroun in northern Lebanon. And this area is of high importance because for the United States, because they are holding, implicitly they are holding certain air bases and naval bases in this region as a means to counterbalance the Soviet or the Russian presence in Syria. That's why I believe that we're a bit far from having a full resolution of the situation. However, I believe that we are heading towards improvement, towards lessening the level of tension in the region.
All right. Thanks a lot, gentlemen. Elijah Magnier, journalist and political analyst, joining us from Brussels. Also, thanks to Professor of International Relations at Lebanese University, Jamal Wakim, speaking to us from the Lebanese capital, Beirut. With that, it brings us to an end here on this edition of the News Review, but do stay tuned. There's plenty more to come here on. Welcome back. Former Australian Prime Minister Malcolm Turnbull says his successor deliberately deceived France when he scrapped a mega submarine deal with Paris in favor of U.S. or British alternatives. Turnbull criticized the handling of the switch and accused Scott Morrison of not acting in good faith. He said Morrison's betrayal of France's trust will dog Australia relations with Europe for years. Turnbull's government had approved the submarine deal with France in 2016. Morrison's decision came in the wake of a new strategic alliance between Australia, the United States, and Britain. He said the switch decision was driven by changing dynamics in the Asia-Pacific region. Paris reacted with fury, saying it was kept in the dark until the last moment. France described the cancellation as a stab in the back. The United States says North Korea's missile launches are a threat to the region, but they would not stop Washington from pursuing a diplomatic path forward. A top U.S. envoy made the comment after North Korea announced the test fire of a newly developed hypersonic missile on Tuesday. Sung Kim, who also serves as the U.S. ambassador to Indonesia, said Pyongyang's measure does not change the U.S. position. Earlier in a speech at the United Nations General Assembly, North Korea announced that its weapons tests were within the country's right to self-defense. Pyongyang wants the U.S. and South Korea to scrap their double standards on weapons programs to start diplomatic talks. And that brings us to an end here on this edition of the World News. Do stay tuned, though. Bye.
IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Discovering Islam. Based on the Islamic teachings, the soul lives after the body is dead and decomposed. Based on the same teachings, the souls will be resurrected in their bodies on the Day of Judgment. However, the question is, where would the soul go in the interim period between death and the Day of Judgment? Would they live, or they will be in a state of oblivion? If they live, what type of life they would have? Do they feel happiness and pleasure and pain and agony? What about those souls who have not lived enough to attain merit or demerit? What about the children? What type of life they would have in that interim period? The world of the dead is usually portrayed as the most terrifying realm man has ever imagined. The realm of spooks. We are usually frightened even to think about it. However, based on the Islamic teachings, what comes after death and before the resurrection of the dead is a fascinating world.
The phases of our existence are divided into two. One is called al-dunya, this world, and one is called al-akhirah, what happens afterwards, the hereafter. Dunya is roughly divided into our existence as we walk about on earth and our existence when we lie under the ground. One is dunya, one is barzakh. Both of them are still dunya. They are not akhirah. So we define dunya as everything that happens before the blowing of the trumpet that brings an end to all this life. And that is divided into earthly life and barzakh.
That is the dunya and that is the akhirah. Two very distinct. But there is a buffer world, or a world that in a way brings the two together. You know, it separates the physical world of the laws of physics and the world of spirits. And the two, you know, because of their very different laws and incompatibility, really.
In barzakh, the souls, if you like, are kept in waiting till the rest of humanity catches up with them, so that then they can enter the new phase of their existence, which is to be arrayed in front of their Lord on the Day of Judgment.
With death, we enter a world of wonders. We will have dreamlike experiences, which is far more different from what we now know.
The awareness in barzakh of an individual, believer or unbeliever, is vastly superior to the awareness of even the greatest scholars who are alive now, because there is an element of certainty in the vision that you have in barzakh, which is difficult to get in this world.
This stage of our life, or this stage of journey towards the Lord, is called with different names in Islamic literature. It is sometimes referred to as the middle world, or the world of images, alamul mithal, or the barrier world, barzakh.
Barzakh is a variety of passages into the hereafter.
Something that separates two things is a barzakh. And that's why this realm is called the barzakh, because it divides this life that we live in right now from the hereafter. Although it's a very, very long time in between, nonetheless, since it divides these two from each other and separates them, it has been called the barzakh, where people go.
We call it barzakh because there is an impregnable barrier between that dimension and the dimension in which we live now. It cannot be penetrated back after the soul has passed through it with the help of the angel of death. Now, the Quran states that after they die, behind them is a barrier until the day they are resurrected.
The Quran states, and beyond them is a barzakh, or a barrier, before the day in which they will be brought forth. So the Quranic picture of barzakh is some sort of intermediary phase before the major day of resurrection.
Barzakh in Arabic just means barrier, something that separates two things, like we have, for example, in the verse in Surah Rahman, that the sweet water and the salty water have a barzakh between them. And, you know, these waters can travel together without mixing because there is this impenetrable barrier between them. In the same way, this barzakh, the intermediary world, because it is a buffer, if you like, between life of this world and the Day of Judgment. And these are one-way streets. People do not come back from them.
There is a point in the near-death experience that a lot of people mention, in which they have a point of decision, let's say. It could be sometimes a barrier that they are going to pass, or sometimes it's just a perception that if they move on, it's like a decision made, either I come back, or I stay, come back, I mean, to the intraphysical lives, their lives back.
When we talk about the world of graves, we do not talk about the physical bodies buried here, rotten after a while. We talk about a world of a different dimension. We talk about the souls living in the spiritual bodies. Although they are connected to our world, but they live in a completely different dimension.
The grave referring to here, of course, is a spiritual grave, not the physical grave. You might have an individual who may not even have a grave. God forbid someone dies in the sea, and let's say maybe eaten up by the animals of the sea. So he or she may not even have a grave. But what we're talking about is a spiritual grave, not the physical grave.
Where is the soul of this body now? Does it really live inside this? According to our knowledge and according to the traditions that we have been taught, the soul is not related to this body anymore. The soul is living in a spiritual body. This body, whether rotten or kept intact, is of no use anymore.
The question that comes up is, why is it necessary to even have a barzakh realm, a barzakh world that we go to after death? Why not go straight to the hereafter? First of all, there's a fixed time for the hereafter. And in the Quran it says, "Ilmuha inda Rabbi," and the knowledge of the hour is with my Lord. So that has a fixed time, and now we're living in this life. And at the same time, we believe that the soul doesn't die. The body will die, will deteriorate. But the soul is to live on. Okay, so where is it going to be? What's going to happen? Because the hereafter hasn't arrived yet. The Day of Judgment hasn't arrived yet. Well, that's where it's going to be then. It's going to be somewhere. That somewhere where the soul is residing is called the barzakh.
What is the purpose of barzakh? My idea is that, of course, the Day of Judgment is a day when there will be a collective presence of humanity. But humankind comes to the earth and leaves the earth in groups. We don't all come together and we don't all leave together. But on the Day of Judgment, we all have to arrive together, which means that we need a holding area.
In this seir and this traveling towards Allah and movement towards Allah, this soul is developing slowly. They say that the barzakh is a place where souls are prepared either for the punishment or for the great rewards. In the barzakh, it is where Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala will sometimes have people compensate for what they missed in this life so that they don't miss out on the good stuff on that side. Of course, it doesn't mean that we have a chance to do good deeds there. That is done. But still, those good deeds that we did in this life, those good intentions that some might have had in this life, will have an effect on their development in the barzakh.
The traits that we allow our souls to be occupied in, or the dispositions that we form in this world, they become like the seeds germinated within fertile ground. They sprout and they come to the fullness of their existence, just like a baby through the influence of DNA becomes a fully grown baby, a fetus, before they arrive into this world. So before we arrive into the next world, we fully mature in accordance with those dispositions that we have brought upon our own selves within this world.
It's in that dimension which question about the past life of every individual buried takes place. And that is the world of the grave. That is Alamul Mithal.
Mithal means image, but not like the image we see in the mirror. Rather, it's an image not dependent on mass and matter, hence more abundant with life and freshness.
Sorrow and happiness, pain and pleasure, and any other quality that we experience in this world are but faint shadows reflected from that world on the dull face of the matter, a world in which the heaviness of the matter does not slow down the life, just like what we see in our dreams or experience in our imagination.
The pleasure and the pain of that world and the duration of that world can never be likened to this world, because in this world everything is watered down. My fullness of my pleasures cannot come to the fore, nor my pains or my fears, because there are limitations through matter. But in that world there are no limitations.
The spiritual grave could be either a place of garden, heaven, paradise. Someone feels that he or she is receiving the blessings of God Almighty. Or it could be one of the pits of fire where the punishment will constantly endure.
The soul is subjected to confinement, pain, punishment, sickness, and grief, as they are to various states of joy, rest, bliss, and freedom. Now, all these are, of course, experienced in the spiritual body and not by the physical body.
In Barzakh, we would feel pain, sorrow, and happiness, absolutely, because these are aspects that deal with the nafs, and it does not deal with the physical body. Although they say there are some happy hormones in the body, there are some painful hormones in the body, but these would come as consequences, you know. So the soul or the nafs is what feels the pain and the pleasure, and that, since it never dies, it's not the physical body that feels the pain and the pleasure. No, it's reflected on the physical body, but it's actually the soul or the nafs that is feeling it.
The Quran states that the life of this world is just play and sport, and that the real life will come in the hereafter. As the middle world or barzakh is one step ahead towards the hereafter, the life there must be much richer than what is experienced here.
The whole context that we understand this world is different over there, and therefore it's very difficult for that human being. And same thing when the day of resurrection, everything we know about that world and this world is going to be completely different as well.
This life is seen in Islam and the Quranic vision of Islam as being purely instrumental. It is a means to something much more. Okay, this life is simply a process through which we can start to fulfill the divine potential which is within us, to live beyond the bounds and limits of this material world.
When the souls arrive in Barzakh, they find themselves in a new form of living in which the intensity of life and its dimensions are exponentially increased. The soul in its mithali body is the swiftest thing in moving, relocating, ascending or descending from one place to another. However, based on the degree of their completion, they can be divided into various categories.
One cannot imagine how exciting the arrival of the soul to that world may be. It's so lush, so astonishing, so glorious, that it leaves the soul to marvel for a long time. It's an experience like the birth of the baby into this world from the womb. Now, the difference, however, is that the baby cannot remember anything from its previous world, whereas the baby's soul is very astute and can feel the difference.
There is a constant progression towards Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala at whatever age we go. The soul is not really bothered with whether it is 20 years old or 200 years old when it leaves the body. It is still very young in the great journey that is yet to come. It is an infant. It's just a case of relativeness. Yeah? Because when you're talking about the Day of Judgment itself being 50,000 years long, and Barzakh, God knows how many hundreds of thousands of years long, 200 years or 2 years old becomes very relative. The soul is still young, it has a lot of maturity and a lot of learning to do still.
By entering into that world, the soul moves one step forward and its powers to comprehend the realities of existence increase. It is now one stage closer to the final destination, meeting with the Lord.
When the Prophet went to the dead of the Meccans that lay on the battlefield of Badr, he said, "Do you find the promise of God to be true?" The Sahaba said, "Ya Rasulullah, bal amwat." "O Messenger, these are dead people." He said, "No, asma'a minkum wa absar." He said, "No, they hear more than you do, and they see more than you do."
People in Barzakh are of different types, much more diverse than we see in this world. They eat and drink, but not of things of this world, and dwell, but not in places of this world.
Their food and drink and dress, their houses and furniture, their cities and neighborhoods are of diverse and dissimilar kinds. They may be poor or rich, beautiful or ugly, and happy or miserable. They are all based on what they have done in this world.
The Islamic tradition has references to three groups. Group number one, the believers. Again, I stress on the fact, believers, not Muslims. A disbeliever can be a Muslim. The believers who have acted in accordance with their faith, they practice what they preached, those will be enjoying some of the features of heaven in that world. On the other side, the second group, the disbelievers, could be Muslims, are unfortunately suffering from some of the punishments that they will be subjected to in the hereafter, after the Day of Judgment. And there's a third group, who some of the tradition describe as they are neither the first group nor the second group. They are a group of people who maybe they were not subjected to enough knowledge. They will be in a state of as if they were asleep. God will just leave them.
For believers, life in Barzakh is going to be fascinating. They live in vast expanses with bespoken landscapes around mansions and palaces furnished with luxurious furniture in their lounges and rooms.
They are served by innumerable some number of servants with inner and outer beauty with no purpose but to serve their masters. Now bear in mind that none of these are physical objects. They all belong to the spiritual world, a world an image of which is reflected in our world.
All these are there to strengthen their love and appreciation for the God they are going to meet after this stage of their life. However, we have to be careful not to confuse this exuberant life with what awaits them in the eternal paradise, as the quality of life there is in no way comparable with what they experience here in the middle world.
We have a basic understanding of what paradise has: the beautiful scenery, the palaces, the service, the gardens, but actually there's more to it. Meeting the Lord, proximity to Allah, seeing Allah with the heart, seeing God with the heart, is a theme that the Quran encourages people to think about.
Here we need to talk about one other type of life in Barzakh: the life of those who have died at a young age and have not developed into good or evil souls.
Compared to the grown-ups, the children who die at a young age have one advantage and one disadvantage. Now, on the positive side, they are sinless and hence open to any concept and wisdom that the angels may teach them. On the negative side, they have not developed concepts, feelings, and thoughts which are prerequisite for ultimate wisdom.
The views about what judgment will be passed on those who have died at a young age differ. Most Christian theologians believe that only those children who are baptized would attain salvation. The majority of Muslim theologians, however, believe that every child who has died at a young age would be saved.
If a child dies before he has the mental maturity to choose between right and wrong, that child will continue to exist because he was born for eternity, but he will not, of course, be subjected to any judgment because he didn't have the mental capacity to choose.
They can only be taught to a restricted degree, and deeper aspects of wisdom cannot be known by them.
These teachings have two aspects. One, to teach them the wisdom and the knowledge that are prerequisites for entering that realm. And two, to cleanse them from the wrong teachings given to them by their parents or their society that is a hindrance for entering the holy realm.
Their purity is very different from the purity of the grown-ups. It is this latter purity and the depth of wisdom corresponding to it which determine the place of every individual in the final abode.
We have people out there who envy those who die at a young age. They say this child, this youth, he died before getting a chance to sin and before getting the chance to become a bad person. He's so lucky. But if you look at it from Allah's perspective, it's not necessarily something good.
Children cannot enter the territory of the righteous immediately after death. They live in a very beautiful interim space under the guidance and training of the angels to prepare them for entering that realm.
It's not an art. It's not something big to evade the punishment of the hereafter. That's not what we're here for. Not going to the hellfire is not something hard. It's easy. Allah's mercy is too great. Allah will forgive with the slightest excuse. What's hard is to gain higher levels of closeness to Him. So this isn't something that we should actually ask for. A person who dies young didn't have the chance to develop. Of course, it doesn't mean that he's going to be in a bad position on that day, but he won't benefit from all the good stuff either.
One cannot wait to see the wonders we are promised in the world of Barzakh, a world which takes us one step further to our final destination, meeting with the Lord, a world which empowers us to an extent unimaginable for us in this life. However, we have not exhausted all our topics about the fascinations of the world of Barzakh. Join me in the next episode of Discovering Islam to talk about those topics. Until then, peace be with you.
وقضى ربك ألا تعبدوا إلا إياه وبالوالدين إحسانا.
Your Lord has decreed that you shall not worship anyone except Him, and He has enjoined kindness to parents.
For humanity.
Allah, Allah.
سيد عبد الله الموسوي.
أعوذ بالله من الشيطان الرجيم. بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم. Brothers and sisters, dear listeners, Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh, and welcome to IRIB English Radio, and you are listening to the program for humanity. We are looking at the bad and side effect or bad side effects of corruption on the social arena, in society, or on a global level. Corruption contributes to the spread of despair among citizens and the spread of frustration that negatively affects work and creativity of the citizen and people. The only way that any society or any country can flourish is when the people, the members of such a system, the citizens of such a system, when they have full capacity to work and be creative. And creativity itself, it comes when a person has the means of comfort. Let's not say like 100%, but at least he's not deprived of the essentials. He have, you know, care system is there, health system is there, education system is there, I don't know, there's a pay system happening in case someone cannot find employment, and so on and so forth. When some of these are met, as human beings, we will flourish, and we will produce, and we will be creative, we will create, we will invent. Thus, society develops. We make the lives of others a lot easier. But when corruption is there, and people are not getting their rights, their mental state deteriorates, and then they have nothing. So instead of me being imaginative and being creative and being, I don't know, a scientist and trying to invent and create, I'm going to be in a sense of despair, in a sense of utter frustration, in a sense of just trying to worry about my day, worry about my family. The last thing that will come to my mind is how to save humanity, for example, or how to cure a disease, or how to invent something that might serve others. I wouldn't be thinking about that, because I need to live. I need to find my way in this messed up world. So it does create a problem. So people don't have work, for example. It will affect their creativity, their imagination, their ability to invent. And also it affects the work itself, even those who work, because they work under extreme circumstances and they're not getting enough of what they should be getting, then obviously the amount of work, or the quality of work, I should say, that they put in is not going to be the same. When, for example, you live in a system where the system is not giving its workers enough wages, the wages are not enough to support them monthly or weekly or fortnightly, those people who work under that system, their work will be less. The quality of it will be a lot less, which will affect, obviously, the rest of the people, would affect me and you. For example, if we go to a department, I'm trying to get a driver's license, and those people who work in this department, they're not getting enough money. Do you think they're going to be happy serving me, or they're going to be excited trying to give me a service? Some people might do that, some of the workers, out of their own will, out of their own genuine, pure heart. But a lot of them say, you know what, I don't give a damn about what's happening to people. I'm just going to sit at the table, do as much as I can, but without putting that effort. So it does affect their work as well. Not only it affects their work, but it affects also their creativity on whether we're talking on a social level or on a, you know, just an individual level, because people would have that mental problem to deal with, yet alone trying to create. Let us take a break, then we continue, inshallah.
Dear listeners, you are listening to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran. You can send us your emails, comments, and questions at EnglishRadio@irib.ir.
Welcome back, brothers and sisters, and you are still listening to IRIB English Radio and to the program for humanity. Corruption usually allows people who live in a state to migrate from their countries, from their comfort place, to seek comfort somewhere else. And sometimes we lose people who are qualified. So, for example, you could live in a country where you have a lot of scientists, you have a lot of doctors, you have a lot of visionary people. But those people, they live in a state or in a country where it does not give them the bare minimum to live. What do you think that will happen? Or what do you think will happen in this case? Obviously, those people will try to migrate to a different state, to a different place, where they could provide for themselves and for their family and create a better living and standard of living for themselves. So if I was a doctor and I live in a country where the economy is so bad and so corrupt, and, for example, the currency is so low compared to a lot of places, I say, well, you know what? I'm better off in a different country. Let me migrate. Let me move somewhere else where a doctor gets paid high and their living standards are a lot higher. So they migrate. And this migration, then we have a problem that the society that they left becomes crumbled. It doesn't have enough doctors, or at least doesn't have qualified doctors, good qualified doctors, or scientists, or what have you, whatever qualification that you can think of. They will leave their societies empty-handed, and then that society itself will only get worse and worse and worse, to the state where maybe even the citizens themselves decide to leave because they say, well, you know, if I need anything good, I'm not going to find it here. I'm going to find it somewhere else. If I want a good surgeon, surely he's not going to be here, so I have to travel to another country because all the surgeons in my country, for example, they went to this country. And we can see that happening. For example, if you look at the civilized countries, you see the top surgeons and top doctors and top scientists are actually people who belong to another country. They are foreigners to the countries they are in, even though they might have a citizenship, a green card, or what have you. But at the end of the day, they are, you know, they came from the Middle East, for example, or from India, or from China, Asia, Russia. They just had to migrate because these countries was not providing them what they need because there was a sense of corruption, because there were people who are in power who did not care and do not care of what happens to people, migrate or don't migrate. They say, well, as long as I'm happy, as long as my wealth is accumulated, as long as my bank account is fat, who cares about people? They can worry about their own. They don't like it, they could move somewhere else. This is the mentality that a lot of systems have. And that's why people get so frustrated and get so anxious and worried, and, you know, they fall into this state, and sometimes they uprise, sometimes they revolt, sometimes they create havoc in that system, and a lot of lives get lost in the process, and so on and so forth. Only because some people decide to deprive the rest of the people their necessities and create that sense of corruption in such a society. So it's not something that we should take lightly and look at as a minor thing. We'll leave it up to here. We continue in episodes to come. Until then, stay with us. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh. Salli ya Rabbi ala Taha al-Amin, rahmatin arsaltahu lil alamin, wa ala ali nabi ajma'in, fabihim narjuka ahsin khatmina. What you heard was an IRIB English Radio program. Our website is www.parstoday.com/en.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.